DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
In this edition, secret resistance in Cambodia. Mining in Brazil, does it really boost development? And a new global compact for migration. We talk to the UN's special representative for migration, Louise Aba. Welcome to World in Progress in Bonn, Germany. I'm Anke Rasper. The number of migrants and refugees around the world is increasing, and many countries are currently struggling with illegal migration. To better regulate migration internationally, the United Nations have been negotiating a new global compact for safe, orderly, and regular migration. After months of negotiations, the draft text is supposed to be finalized this week. To find out more about this new compact, I caught up with Louise Aba in New York. She's the UN Special Representative for Migration and has been part of the negotiations from the outset. I first asked her why a global compact for migration is needed.
Well, I think we just have to look at what happened in Europe, you know, starting around 2015, to realize that the fact that the United Nations had never before seriously and in a global fashion addressed human mobility, it produced a kind of chaos that happened then, and that is actually happening in lots of other parts of the world, but maybe less visibly with less media coverage. So I think it generated a consciousness that as much as states are very wary of any encroachment on their sovereignty when it comes to migration issues, they've also come to understand that it can only work if there's a better cooperative framework. That's the genesis and the impetus for where we are today.
As you said, there is currently a lot of problems that illegal migration is causing in many countries. And obviously, there are very different interests of the countries involved. How difficult is it to even agree on new regulations?
These are not regulations as such. The Global Compact is, broadly speaking, an agreement by member states to cooperate with each other through a variety of initiatives towards a series of objectives, essentially to increase safe, orderly, and regular migration, and therefore to decrease a disorderly, unsafe, chaotic, illegal, irregular migration. I mean, that's the general framework. The other thing that I think is really important to keep in mind is, even though we often think of countries in a very stereotypical ways, like we think of Europe as an area of destination, and we think of Africa as an area of origin. In reality, in the world today, most countries are everything. They're countries of origin, they're countries of transit, they're countries of destination. At any given time, in the negotiations, I think the member states came to realize that there was a lot of common interest. There's lots of disagreement. We have to be very clear on this.
Can you give an example?
Well, for instance, there was a lot of debate about what are the best ways to discourage irregular. Member states understand that it's their interest and it's in the interest of migrants to increase legal channels and then they disagree actually on what response they should give to the situation of irregular migrants. Well, actually, the compact itself very explicitly recognizes that states have the right to determine their migration policies. However, what the current reality shows us is international cooperation is the key to the preservation, actually, of state sovereignty.
Now, this migration compact will not be legally binding for any of the countries. But if it's not legally binding, what can it achieve?
So you can spend a lot of time negotiating something that purports to be legally binding, and then it has very limited effect. This one does not create a set of new legal obligations. It reaffirms existing ones, and there are lots of obligations that already exist under, for instance, international humanitarian law. But to the extent that there's real political will to make this cooperative framework work, it will, in my view, produce much better result. And, you know, if member states come together and say, we agree to pursue these 23 objectives seriously, all together in a global fashion, not overnight, but over time, I think we're going to see better results. It's a very challenging issue, there's no question, but I think in 20 years, we'll look back at 2018 as the beginning of a genuine effort to facilitate, to harness the benefits of human mobility and to mitigate its negative aspects. So this is step one, big one, but first step.
Thank you so much for your time, Ms. Arbour.
Very happy to talk to you.
That was Louise Arbour, UN Special Representative for Migration, talking about the new Global Compact for Safe, Orderly and Regular Migration that will be finalized on July the 13th. And you can find a longer version of this interview online at dw.com later this week. Cambodia is preparing for national elections that will be held at the end of this month. But critics of the government say the polls are a sham. Prime Minister Hun Sen, who has been in power for over 30 years, has effectively neutralized his opponents in media and politics. Whoever dares to speak out against the government is at risk of being arrested and put in jail. Yet a secret opposition is rising, as DW correspondent Chris Janssens reports.
I have to do this work. If I stop, who can work this work? Because it's very dangerous, as you see.
This is Elika.
They can kill me by making the traffic accident because I am an activist.
Elika is a member of the now forbidden environmental organization Mother Nature, or Madai Thammachit. She takes me to Koh Kong province in Cambodia's west. To make space for a major tourist project, a large piece of land has been taken here by a private company without compensating the owners, but with the approval of the government.
We cannot cross there. We cannot. You see, they close the... they block the road. They close the gate.
People are gathering and selling drinks under a canvas tent along a dusty road. We try to get into the locked area to talk to inhabitants, but the main road is blocked.
They will wonder why we come here.
We can't stay here too long. A suspicious car is making Elika nervous.
Someone is trying to look at us. You don't see it? The car behind you is coming. We should protect ourselves because I have to come here again, you know? You understand?
We try to find another way in to be sure no one follows us.
Are you afraid of being arrested?
No. Sometimes, yes. Because if they arrest me, it wastes my time. I'm in the jail. Who can help the community?
We arrive at a two-story wooden house of widow Ngon Buon, who lives with her family in a deserted village inside the area claimed by the company. Most of her neighbors have left in the past few months, but they never got a compensation payment that the company had promised to pay for their property. Elika helps the widow with legal advice and explains how she could sue the company.
The company says that my late husband promised to leave before he died.
Ngun Buon's husband died last year. The family shows me where the body is buried, under a pile of sand in the backyard.
Before he died, he said, "Please don't move me. Please bury me here."
But this widow is not sure her husband's grave will keep her property safe.
I want to stay here.
The company can act without interference thanks to a corrupt deal with the government, says Alex Gonzalez-Davidson, co-founder of the NGO Mother Nature. He lived in Cambodia for 12 years until he was expelled in 2015.
You can't make business in Cambodia at that scale, you know, large-scale business investment, if you don't pay bribery. It is impossible. So a lot of businesses are like, oh, I can't get involved there. So what do you end up with? You end up with like mafiosi, pseudo-mafia businesses from China, from Vietnam, which are not really businesses. There's just a group of people who register something in Cambodia in the Ministry of Commerce. The Ministry of Commerce does not anymore make public any information at all. They used to a little bit, now they've crossed it out. And I understand why that is. A thief, simply put, a thief will always try and have the least amount of transparency as possible because he's stealing. And yes, There is no parliament. There is a parliament, it's just not a real parliament where real debate is going on.
The Cambodian League for the Promotion and Defense of Human Rights, or LICADO, works in 13 Cambodian provinces, which is roughly half the country. The organization says in this area more than 250,000 people have been affected by land grabbing and forced evictions since 2003. I am in a car with Bun Torn and Rexmi, two members of the biggest opposition party, the Cambodian National Rescue Party, or CNRP, which was officially abolished last year. We are about to meet Vanak, another member of CNRP, who is currently in jail. Rexmi tells me why.
He was accused of being involved in a scuffle. In the police office, he was bluntly told he could leave jail immediately, on one condition, that he would leave the opposition party and join the government's party, CPP, instead. He refused and was put into prison immediately.
We arrive at the jail. Family members are gathering in a little police office where visitors have to register before being permitted to see the prisoner. They carry bags with food and clothes. One by one, the names of the prisoners who can receive visitors are being called. Vanak's friends and family have to wait more than 1 hour before it's finally their turn. First, the mother goes in, then his wife with their little son, and then the colleagues. They get 5 minutes to talk to him. Bun Torn and Rexmi look satisfied after their short visit to Vanak. He has impressed them with his unbroken spirit, they say. This gives Bun Torn and Rexmi hope.
We will continue doing political work and assist people in word and deed, without telling them, however, that we are members of CNRP. The party stays in our hearts and will rise again one day.
Threatening people is part of the system, says activist Alex Gonzalez-Davidson.
Less than 10 years ago, there were people being murdered for being members of the opposition party in remote part of the country, and it was not even reported in the press. So when you have people connected to each other on smartphones and Facebook, and you have international media picking up these stories, then you've got to be a bit more subtle, a bit more careful. So what they're doing now more and more is using the judicial weapon, the courts. They can accuse you of anything they want. They will frame it as, it's an independent decision by the judicial branch. It's not the executive branch. Don't ask me. And what the Hun Sen dictatorship will do very effectively is, it doesn't need to throw all of them in jail. Just one or two and make an example. And then it will scare the rest of the people. It's the same with the media. It's the same with the NGO world. It's the same with the syndicates. So that's a very important part of the equation. That's how you threaten people.
This is Dara. He used to produce a political radio program in Cambodian for the American channel RFA, Radio Free Asia. But the radio shows broadcasted from Cambodia were shut down last year. The official reason was that the company didn't have the necessary licenses to work as a news broadcaster in the country. After two of his colleagues got arrested, Dara now works from abroad. But he still doesn't feel very safe.
I just feel homesick, missing my family, feel missing my parents, my sister. I have lots of good memory in Cambodia. But yeah, it's better to stay here rather than in the prison. For the first time, I feel afraid too, but after a few months staying here, it's not a good place to go. It's very near to the loop.
We see police officers, and it seems safer to turn the corner and enter a bar. Here he tells me about this particular day in September, when his radio office was closed down.
RFA posted a statement saying that RFA decided to close down the office bureau. I feel so sad. It's just like my soul went out of my body.
Dara now sends his texts to Washington in the United States, where they are being broadcasted after all. Cambodians can only listen to the station on a shortwave frequency.
I have no voice anymore on the radio, but I just want to find a way that I can help
people by broadcasting news programs about land grabbing, illegal logging, environmental issue, or corruption issue.
Other critical media have been shut down too, like the Cambodia Daily, a newspaper that also received US funding. Many Cambodians now go to Facebook for independent information, as long as that is not controlled by the government as well. This video criticizes the government using a Sesame Street-like puppet called Sangha. In the video, Sangha condemns the illegal sand dredging that is going on in a natural protected area. The puppet's anonymity allows the author of the spot to talk freely about corruption. He agrees to meet me if I promise he can talk anonymously. Sangha's alter ego is a skinny young man who invites me to his humble apartment.
I could evacuate this place within 1 hour if necessary. I will put all my stuff on a tuk-tuk and I'm gone. In the beginning, I was afraid every time I saw a police officer, but I have learned how to deal with this fear.
He records in his bedroom in front of a green screen that allows him to insert images while editing the video. He has the same fighting spirit I saw in the others who criticize corruption in the country.
Three things can happen to me. I get killed, or jailed, or deported, but that doesn't stop me.
It seems this voice is speaking on behalf of many among the young generation that is no longer satisfied with the status quo. Alex Gonzalez-Davidson, co-founder of Mother Nature, is not very positive for the near future of Cambodia.
A lot of people used to be happy with the status quo 10 years ago, 5 years ago, because they were fooled into it, because they knew nothing else, and it's actually, okay, this guy is a member of the party which got rid of the Khmer Rouge. We have to thank him, you know? Now it's like people have had enough. People only want regime change. So Hun Sen realizes that. So before the regime dies, it will bite. Just like a snake, once it's been injured, it will not die quietly. The snake will always bite you, even though it knows that the snake is going to die. And that's exactly what's going to happen. I'm very positive for the long-term prospects of the country, but I'm actually 90% sure that things will become really, really bad in the next few months and years to come.
Of course, we'd have liked to balance this report with a statement from Cambodian officials. But Cambodian officials hardly talk to the media and don't welcome critical questions. For example, the deputy governor of Phnom Penh told human rights organization Likado that the activities of land grabbing and tearing down homes was not an eviction, but just an effort to clear the area for development. When the NGO Global Witness published a report in 2010 saying some 700,000 tons of sand had been dredged without permission, the Cambodian government dismissed this claim as cheap and rubbish, stating the allegations were malicious and misleading. More recently, Prime Minister Hun Sen himself threatened anyone who would demonstrate against him during the ASEAN-Australia summit held in March this year in Sydney.
If they dare make an effigy of me and burn it, I will pursue them to their houses and beat them up. I tell you in advance.
2018 is about to become a pivotal year for Cambodia. Chris Janssens, DW in Cambodia.
And our last report today takes us to Brazil. Mining is on the rise in the country, and the government hopes that mining will make up a greater share of the country's GDP soon. Last month, Brazilian President Michel Temer issued a pair of decrees updating Brazil's 5-decade-old mining code with the goal of encouraging more investment in the sector. One of the mining projects already underway is located in Brazil's southern state of Rio Grande do Sul. But is mining really bringing development and resources to cash-strapped towns and municipalities? Michael Fox has the story.
The sun breaks on Vero Colares' farm far in the hills of southern Brazil. A rooster crows, a cow moos in the distance, mist rises from the pond. Vera is 53. She's recently retired from her job at Brazil's Department of Federal Revenue and returned to take care of her aging mother and the farm. Her family has lived here for more than 2 centuries. Usually around this time, she would set about to tend to the chores on the farm. Not today.
Alô? Tá bem. Eu já tô chegando aí daqui a pouco. Tá.
Her little car rattles over kilometers of dirt roads as she talks about their struggle against the mine. Vera, her sister Marcia, and most of their neighbors are facing what they consider the battle of their lives. 2 years ago, they learned that a major copper, zinc, and lead open pit mine was set to open just 5 kilometers from their farm, downstream from the Camaquã River that runs alongside many of their properties. The mining company Nexa is looking to extract more than 1 million tons of minerals worth roughly $3.5 billion. Nexa has until August to hand in the latest environmental impact statement. It hopes to begin production by next year. The company says the minerals can be extracted cleanly. Biologists say the mine will wreak havoc on the local ecosystem, spewing toxic particulates into the air for kilometers and polluting the river beyond repair. Vera and her family say it would mean the death of their farm and their community.
The wind can carry the pollution that will be in the air from the lead for 60 kilometers. So the whole region will be affected. All of the life here. The river, the fish, the animals.
When they found out about the mine, Vera and her neighbors founded the Union for the Preservation of the Camaquã River. Vera says they just had to do something.
Everyone assumed that the mine was a foregone conclusion. That's when we started to fight and demand public hearings. And when the state environmental agency asked for more documents, that helped to slow things down.
Rincón do Inferno, or Hell's Corner, is a rocky formation on the banks of the Camaquã River. It's like a scene of some lost paradise. Massive granite boulders rise from the riverbed and the surrounding jungle. Vera and dozens of her neighbors and supporters follow the trail down through the forest to the river. This region, less than 150 kilometers or about 90 miles from Brazil's southern border with Uruguay, is one of the most pristine ecosystems in the state and one of Brazil's few remaining preserved areas of the Pampa biome, an expanse of grasslands located across southern South America. Vera's group has been successful at galvanizing people against the mine across the state. But the mining project has received major support from the Rio Grande do Sul state government, the Caçapava do Sul mayor's office, and many locals who are encouraged by the promise of jobs and local investment. Nexa Resources, the company behind the mine, has launched a stylish website to promote the sustainability of the project. They've also promised to contract workers locally and to provide resources for community projects. The company is expecting to spend more than $100 million in the initial phase and generate 450 jobs. Good news as the country emerges from its worst recession ever.
You need jobs.
That's Neri Pires, a 61-year-old taxi driver from Bagé, a town just south of the proposed mine.
I'm for the mine because it's money for the state, money that's going to circulate.
But is it? That's the question that a team of economists has been grappling with 370 kilometers away in the state capital of Porto Alegre. They're members of the six-year-old Tax Justice Institute, a largely volunteer-run organization with the goal of ensuring that the tax system is used to reduce social inequality. The question then, exactly how much benefit do local municipalities and states see from mining projects in Brazil? João Carlos Lobens is a state revenue tax auditor and an advisor to the group.
In reality, the mining company pays very little taxes. They pay almost nothing. They extract the minerals, and when they are exported, practically everything is exempt. They don't pay anything. There's no tax, just the tax on the profit. How do they get around that? They open a subsidiary in Switzerland, send the product to themselves at cost or at under cost, and then they sell it to China, and that's where they add the profit. From Brazil, the product is exported at cost, zero profit. They don't pay any taxes on the real profit.
Lucro zero, não paga imposto sobre o lucro.
According to a study by the Tax Justice Institute, This setup costs Brazil billions of U.S. dollars per year in lost tax revenue just from iron exports. Companies do pay royalties and a mining tax, but that's only somewhere between 2 and 3.5%, depending on the mineral. According to the Institute, these percentages are much lower in Brazil than in countries like Australia, Canada, or even Chile. So low, says Lobens, that most mines in Brazil generate more costs than benefits for the state. That's because the local municipalities often promise to develop roads and infrastructure for the mine. They also cover unemployment when the company pulls out, and healthcare costs through Brazil's state system when workers get sick. That's not even taking into account the environmental damage, increased community health risks, drug and alcohol abuse, and sexual violence that have accompanied mines across the country. According to Karina Lorenzo from the Brazilian Movement of Communities Affected by Mining, these issues come with the influx of male workers and the loss of traditional livelihoods such as fishing and farming because of the contamination of the local ecosystem.
Nasce Nexa.
But this financial scheme seems to be exactly the plan for the Brazilian company behind the Caçapava do Sul mine. Last October, it changed its name from Votorantim Metais to Nexa Resources. It became publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange and moved its headquarters to Luxembourg, at least on paper.
It's easy. It's common and it happens with a lot of businesses, not just Brazilian companies.
Luis Alfonso Fernandes Lima is the director of the Brazilian Society for the Study of Transnational Businesses. His office in an upscale neighborhood in Sao Paulo is just down the street from the 18-story office building that Nexa Resources still runs most of its operations out of. Is it legal? Logistically, yes. But the main reason to do it is to skirt the system.
The advantage is this. Luxembourg already has a low tax rate, and you wouldn't pay any taxes here in Brazil. So you have the benefit of paying fewer taxes there in Luxembourg.
Luxembourg, like Switzerland, Holland, and Belgium, is a fiscal paradise, with extremely low tax rates that are enticing to global corporations. According to Lima, tiny Holland is actually the second largest investor in Brazil, with more than $10 trillion in investments in 2016. Or perhaps we should say corporations operating out of Holland are the second largest investor in Brazil.
Why? Because many Japanese, German, or Korean companies invest in Holland first, and then in Brazil.
In other words, they invest via Holland because they can do it tax-free. And not just German, Japanese, or Korean companies, but Brazilian businesses like Nexa. In fact, the top four countries for foreign direct investment in Brazil are all fiscal paradises: the United States, Holland, British Virgin Islands, and Luxembourg. Yes, even the U.S., home to the largest percentage of offshore financial services of any country in the world. The problem is clearly not Brazilian, it's global. And in this story of offshore accounts, foreign investment, and pseudo-legal tax evasion, it's easy to forget the people who are most affected. Back at the Camaquã River, Vera Colares wades into the cool waters.
It's just unimaginable for the people here. They told us our entire lives that we needed to protect and preserve the river. And suddenly, all of that means nothing? Suddenly, all of that can be destroyed for something that is not going to benefit this region. It's not going to benefit our community. The minerals are going to be almost completely exported, and they're not even going to benefit the country.
The sun is low in the sky. People begin to collect their things and hike back up the trail. With billions of dollars at stake, it's clear they have a long road ahead. But Vera is defiant.
We are going to fight until the end. As we say, as long as we have just one drop of blood in our veins, we are going to fight.
Michael Fox, DW, Caçapava do Sul, Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil.
And that report from Brazil wraps up the show for today. To listen again to this and other editions of World in Progress, go to dw.com/worldinprogress or download our podcast from iTunes or SoundCloud. And for more globalization stories, go to Facebook at DW Global Society. World in Progress will be back next week. For today, on behalf of the studio team here in Bonn, Germany, I'm Anke Rasper saying thanks for tuning in and take care.